Bill Simmons is start of the Grantland Network.
Grantland Network.
Basically, he's rounded up some people capable of talking about sports and other stuff, too, in an entertaining way, if I were to take a guess.
This is the Grantland Network.
Welcome to the Hollywood Perspectives Podcast. My name is Chris Ryan. I'm a writer for Grantland.com. And on the other line, standing at his window naked on LSD, it's Andy Greenwald.
I can see so many lights from here.
Yes.
It's beautiful.
Andy, we're going to throw a little bit of a curveball at our listeners, a la Cole Hamels. We've got the Sunday Night Television wrap-up, as per usual. We're going to do the Mad Men finale. I know everybody's been counting the seconds till that happened. But, you know, first we want to talk about the big movie out there, because we saw it together, Prometheus.
Yeah, we saw a movie together, just like old times.
Just like Siskel and Ebert.
Just like the two of us seeing a Bourne movie at 2 p.m. on August Tuesday in New York City or something.
Back in the aughts.
Back in the mid-aughts.
Yeah,
this was exciting. We went to the Arclight, a very fancy Los Angeles cinema.
The Cinerama Rama Dome.
Yeah, the Ding Dong Dome. We sat there, the two of us. And I should note, Chris, I saw you strap on the goggles,
yeah,
despite having said on the record, on this podcast, in fact, that you think 3D films are racist.
I think I'm Matt Biondi. Yeah, I had the goggles on. You know, whatever. Like, I wanted to feel, you know, really like a part of Noomi Rapace's world. You know,
which is fascinating. Although it does make me reconsider all your opinions on the film, since you in fact did not see it.
No, I was definitely watching What to Expect When You're Expecting on a phone while you guys were watching this movie.
But probably a better move.
We should also note that if I was somewhat inhibited, or you know, if I had some hamstrung by my vision, Andy was hamstrung by his failing liver function, because
see, don't go there.
No, the night before he was drinking gin and Red Bull. So
wait, look. If you're going to go there,
I just snitched you out.
I will talk about your pastel shirt. I'm not afraid to bring that up on this podcast.
Come on, man. Everybody knows that it's that retro vampire weekend thing is back again.
Look, all I'm going to say is I was in Los Angeles for a short amount of time. It was an intense few days.
Yeah.
You know, I like to approach a visit to Los Angeles with the same sort of tense focus that the punk rock geologist approaches his job in Prometheus.
Yeah,
you know, I'm just there to do some work, and I'm there to drink a little bit. That's about it. It was intense. It was an intense couple of days. Mistakes were made. There was a margarita machine, as you know, on the premises. So
yeah.
What do you do after that? You got to keep stepping it up.
Yeah, and you step it up by going to an heretofore undiscovered world and learning all about how we as people were made. Because that's what happens in Prometheus.
Yeah.
You know, Zach Baron wrote about this this movie for Grantland.com, and I think that I kind of am starting to fall more behind his idea. Like, this movie's growing in my estimation the farther I get away from it, even though it has some serious structural problems. What did you think?
That's interesting, because I'm going in the opposite direction. The farther we get from it, the less I think of it, to be honest. Let's preface this with the good stuff, right? Obviously, we had a crisp picture experience, or at least I did, because I can see out of my eye sockets.
I did not know that Deborah Winger was in this movie, but it seemed like it.
But she looks great.
Yeah.
I would say that this is an incredibly beautiful film. I really like Zach's piece that he wrote for us for Grantland, because I think that he wrote it from a place of like summer movie fatigue, even though it's not even summer yet. And the fact that this movie is, you know, beautiful and interesting and creative and trying to do something new, that alone sets it apart and made me excited to see it and very happy to sit through it. The first 10-15 minutes are just incredibly beautiful.
Yeah.
Michael Fassbender, who we can speak a lot about, and we could speak about parts of him that, you know, we shouldn't.
Guy's got a great hairline.
Great, crisp hairline. Is so good in this film. And the first 10 minutes of the movie, which is just him, you know, watching Lawrence of Arabia, riding a bike, shooting hoops in an empty
working
spacecraft.
Working on his post-game with the Dream. Oh, no.
As it hurtles through space. I mean, that suggested a much weirder, richer, more interesting movie than, I think, the movie that we got.
Yeah, it started off, it has a very 2001 feel in terms of the eerie lack of humanity and just the sort of beats that it's taking in the beginning, and then I think it turns into a much more traditional kind of like, we're going into space, something's out in space, what's in space, we're not really sure, sci-fi movie. I mean, that's kind of like, it's interesting, I feel like this was plagued by the same problems that I wrote about Sunshine having in YouTube Hall of Fame last week for the Sci-Fi YouTube Hall of Fame that we did on the Hollywood Prospectus blog. Sunshine's like a Danny Boyle movie about Cillian Murphy being a nuclear physicist, which LOL, but he has to go to the sun and restart it with a nuclear weapon because the Earth's dying. Really amazing sci-fi movie for the first hour, 15 minutes, and then it turns into basically a horror movie, and that's pretty much the same thing that plagued Prometheus. It's asks a lot of questions. I don't care that it doesn't give a lot of answers, but the way it sort of abandons those questions to turn it into, I don't know. I mean, we're going to speak kind of frankly about the film, so if you haven't seen it, I don't know, skip ahead to Mad Men. But
yeah, let's remind people that if you've downloaded this and you haven't looked at the pod, I mean at the blog, we put timestamps so you can see where you should restart listening.
But my big thing with Prometheus is that there's a scene in the middle, so she gives herself a cesarean. Noomi Rapace's character gives herself a cesarean section and to remove a alien life form from her uterus.
Yeah, that's,
for lack
that's
of
real.
That was pretty intense and pretty like, whoa, I've like not seen this.
With good reason.
Yeah,
that was
what
serious?
To expect when you're expecting, honestly. But
doesn't that happen to Brooklyn Decker?
Yeah. And then it seems like about 45 minutes got cut out of the movie, right? Like it seems like that there was a lot of development of characters that just kind of got like, you know what, we need to keep it moving and get to the big fight at the end.
I mean, let's say let's be clear about a couple things. Like when you have a director like Ridley Scott making a movie like this, he can gloss over a lot of stuff just by making stuff look amazing.
Yeah, I mean, I would have watched Fassbender shooting buckets for about 2.5 hours.
There was a lot of the thing that you sort of I didn't notice when I was watching because it was so smoothly done and I was enjoying it and also I was extremely hungover was that it's very very clunky and I mean that in a lot of ways because obviously right there were two screenplays. There was a straight Aliens prequel that the writer John Spates had written, and then Damon Lindelof came in, and you mentioned you enjoy people asking questions and not being able to answer them. Well, Lindelof's your guy.
he brought the MVP of asking questions.
He brought that polar bear sensibility straight to outer space with us. So his draft of the script was very much like, you know, all of a sudden a space movie has to be about who we are as people, and who we are is apparently the melted DNA fragments of
Dr. Manhattan.
Of Dr. Manhattan with a humpback Dr. Manhattan. But it also trickled down to other ways, too, where, like, the physical placing of the movie, which is that we're on a spaceship, and then we drive to another spaceship, and then we drive back, and then we leave some people there, but then we drive back again.
See, that...
It's clunky.
That's not as... I mean, I feel like... It's interesting you bring that up because I watched Alien right after I saw Prometheus.
You're doing homework.
Yeah, just because sometimes I like to deep dive on the on xenomorphs. And... You know, aside from the fact that I had forgotten that the performances in Alien are almost categorically, like, mind-blowingly good. I mean, Tom Skerritt and John Hurt and Ian Holm and Sigourney Weaver and you just... Yaphet Kotto! Who is basically... I mean, Idris Elba's performance in Prometheus is one long tribute to Yaphet Kotto, it seems like.
Which of his Stills. Of his nine accents are Yaphet Kotto's?
I can't decide if I preferred Cockney or Houston Bun B. But, you know, I really liked... The naturalism of the performances in Alien is what makes it a really special movie. That being said, it has the same sort of physicality problems where they're like in a ship inside of a ship, in a ship inside of a planet. And that carries over to Aliens too. You know, we mentioned Lindelof, Andy, and one of the cool things that sort of made this film grow in my estimation since we've left the Cinerama-rama dome is the internet speculation about the meaning of the film and also the kind of like pre-Twitter, pre-Tumblr style of that speculation. Like, we're getting links to things on message boards and dudes' live journals where they're, like, breaking down the timelines of the Wayland Industries Corporation.
Yeah.
It's really cool. Like, I feel like it is bad. It does remind me of, like, you know, when Naomi showed up on Lost and everybody was, like, breaking down the biblical allegory that was happening on the show.
Yeah, all the names.
Yeah.
I love that stuff. And I, you know, I've been on record. I'll continue to say that I really, really miss that sort of level of intense, nerdy fan engagement with something that Lost provided. I would take issue with your example of Prometheus as the new Lost only because a great majority of the comments and breakdowns I've seen online are ripping it to shreds. You know, are really pointing at the complete inconsistencies of it. And, like... You know, I think who was it? Our fellow filmgoer Sean Fennessy and editor Grantland sent me the link to one dude who wrote, you know, the essential problem with Prometheus can be boiled down to the fact that the dude whose job it is to make maps gets lost and no one notices.
Yeah, let's talk a little bit about the failings of some of these characters because I really want to talk about Logan Marshall Green, life scientist.
No, science doctor.
Science doctor. This is he's about as convincing as a mob doctor. You know, like.
It's not just that he's not convincing as, you know, a world-changing space doctor. It's also that he discovers they get to a place filled with, like, alien stuff, right? And I'm not clear if humanity has encountered extraterrestrial life before these dummies in the spaceship get there. But they seem weirdly nonplussed about it first. And then second, once they've discovered it and they take back a decapitated alien head, right?
Right.
He gets he's bummed out. Why are you so sour?
He's not bummed out. He gets blitzed. He decides to drink two magnums of Chris.
And then again, another weird choice to bring on a spaceship.
Yeah. Well, here's – and I feel like Logan Marshall Green's supposed to be – aside from the fact he's supposed to be Tom Hardy, he's also supposed to be like the I don't know, like the Juwan Howard of this situation where like he's standing on the sidelines making
he's supposed
really,
to be 100 years old?
Like making wisecracks and giving dudes really cool handshakes. You know what I mean? Like he doesn't contribute anything scientifically to this entire expedition.
He doesn't contribute anything except a bad attitude, frankly, and you know, a demon baby. Get out of here. You're not a glue guy in this team.
Yeah,
he's
really he is not a chemistry guy. Yeah, so I think that this is the same thing that happened with Inception to a lesser degree. I think that Prometheus has a lot more flaws, but you know, when Inception came out, there was like that initial like, what was that? And then everybody's breaking down whether or not any of it made any sense. And I think that the same thing is happening with Prometheus. But here's the thing I love about it is that I read an interview with Ridley Scott where he talked about how the genesis with him and Lindelof's iteration of the sequel or prequel or whatever it is just that scene in Alien where Tom Skerritt and John Hurt walk by what winds up being one of these space jockeys, these guys in the elephant masks.
Right.
And they walk by this guy who's been exploded from the inside, obviously, by an alien.
Right.
And they're just like, what's that? And then they just keep it moving. And Ridley Scott's just like, that. I'm going to take that little slice of this one movie and make another whole thing out of it. And I kind of wish more sequels were like that.
You know what? I feel like the perfect example of that would be if Stanley Kubrick was still alive and he wanted to make a Shining sequel only about the dude in the bear costume giving the other dude a B, you know, a BJ. Like, can we say that, Jacoby? Anyway, I feel like that would be a cool sequel. Like what? But you know, my point of that is only like one of the things that makes the first Alien great is the fact that that's not explained. It's just an incredibly haunting.
Yeah,
image.
It's just like it's just a weird thing that happens.
And it's just very, very, very Lindelofian. And I you know, I love Lost, so I don't want to sound like I'm harping on the guy. But to take like a moment that is beautiful on its own and unexplainable and try to turn it into some like quasi-religious metaphor of enormous significance. You know, just we shouldn't spend too much more time on this, but I want to tick off a couple questions about this movie for you.
Yeah, do it.
Number one, the punk rock geologist who gets lost,
yes.
Right? Why does he become a demon zombie?
There's a couple of different, from what my understanding is that there's a couple of different ways it can go down on that planet for you. Like,
okay.
You could either get, you know, the lizard that comes, like the lizard or whatever, the eel that comes out of the goop can get you, and that
right.
makes you do one thing. Then there's the whole, thing, whatever happens to Logan Marshall Green where he knows he's getting sick. I think that Logan Marshall Green would have been the same situation as the punk rock geologist, turned into a kind of almost a alien Prometheus guy.
So that's if you touch or ingest in some way the jars of black tar heroin that exist on the planet.
And then there's the whatever happens once you get cesareaned or birthed out, and then you like it's like levels of jumping inside of dudes.
So it's right. So it's just like Russian dolls. Of
yeah,
body
exactly.
Heart.
It's basically like that. I mean, I mean,
keep digging. I'm just saying there are so many different things going on.
Next question.
Hold on. Okay, next question. The total body horror self-exam thing, you know, the self-cesarean is super intense, unbelievable movie scene. Why does no one notice that happened to her? Why is no one angry? Like, remember, Scottish doctor's like, we're going to put you back to sleep.
Idris Elba is in the middle of playing Sweet Judy Blue Eyes for Charlize Theron in her bedroom.
Yeah, that's he spends a lot of the movie doing that.
And then Morford and Caller, the doctor, I don't know what she does, but she's somewhere over there.
And then I felt like it was a little much because then we're like, wait, she just stapled her stomach together and is running around. And then it does seem like it, like during the last third of the movie, Ridley Scott remembered the continuity and whispered to Noomi, like, oh, by the way, yell out in pain every 10 seconds.
Yeah, and
just
then
to remind
I guess the only other explanation I have is that the two pilots were like betting on cockfights or whatever they were doing. Those guys seem to only gamble the entire movie.
Yeah, I should also add, and I said this to you when we left the movie, and this was not alcohol blinkered. I do have a serious problem always in movies where people are asked to make heroic self-sacrifices
after not being in the movie the entire time.
That then they're like super into it.
Yeah.
It's like, honestly, I would be pretty pissed off. Okay, next point. Next point.
Guys, this isn't in my contract.
Next point, when they wake up the giant dude who's still alive,
yes.
Right? Why is he in such a bad mood? Like, I'm cranky in the morning, too, okay? And I was especially cranky that morning. But why has he got to rip dude's heads off?
I think he had, like, well gin instead of upper, like, the good stuff. I think he was just mad. I mean, like, obviously the Dr. Manhattans have a bone to pick with the humans. I think they think that we have failed them.
We failed them? Look
yeah.
What they did.
I know. I mean, look, I'm not saying it answers everything. I'm just saying it...
And finally, the very strange decision to cast Guy Pearce as an old man who dies.
Which
right
was
away.
Apparently primarily so that he could show up as a young man in a viral video TED Talk and in a dream sequence that got cut from the movie.
Okay, now let me add, I've seen that viral video TED Talk, and it makes me think that you could take Guy Pearce, slice him paper thin, put him on a plate, and charge $25 for him at any Italian restaurant in New York City. That is how unkosher his performance is as an actor. Okay, am I being clear with what I'm saying
here? I think it's like when Scott Glenn shows up in Apocalypse Now, and you're like, yo, that's Scott Glenn, and then he's not in it anymore. Or
what
it's like any Terrence Malick movie where, like, you know, George Clooney's in it for 12 seconds. And...
What about Patrick Wilson in this?
Apparently
Patrick Wilson was her dad in the grainy dream flashback that the robot can watch because apparently he has dream-watching technology now.
Another Patrick Wilson. Why does Patrick Wilson have to have a different accent?
I don't know. I mean, he's sort of a he's not a boring guy, but he's not exactly the most memorable. I mean, spice it up, Patrick Wilson.
Okay.
Why not? You're gonna die off screen from Ebola, so you might as well have fun with it.
Look, we'll try and tweet out some of the links to these Prometheus explanation
yeah.
sites. But I mean, I just think that as summer movies go, I'm kind of with Zach. It's like, when's the last time since Inception that we've had a summer blockbuster that is this sort of thought provoking and argument starting? And then that way, I think it's just you got to go see it.
I agree, and
it's self-Caesarian.
Yeah, I mean, you're already sold, right? You're pre-sold. I mean, but it was super fun, and I weirdly, despite my overwhelming negativity on this podcast thus far, I would kind of be up for the sequel of Dr. Dragon Tattoo, the continuing adventures of Dr. Dragon Tattoo.
And the head
robot.
Of David, yeah.
Yeah, Fassbender's head.
I was kind of mad that they took Charlize out like that.
Her part is very silly part.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, like, she doesn't do anything.
She continues, she basically starts as this, like, very icy woman, has, like, a quick subplot about, like, with some daddy issues, sleeps with Idris Elba, and then gets rolled on.
And we're even cheated that scene.
Yeah.
You know, I would have watched that scene. But that she gets rolled on, it was too bad. I thought that she and Noomi were just going to, like, be living on that planet together.
Yeah, Lethal Weapon.
Also, do we have any evidence that there's any kind of human food on that planet? For
yeah, here's
to
the thing
on?
Is that I was wondering about that, and I think that, like, astronauts in that era, you know, like, they largely exist on, like, just, like, oatmeal in a cup. Like, if you watch Alien, they just, like, they stay just crushing those. Like, it's just, like, there's not a lot of food eating. I mean, obviously there's food eating in the famous scene in Alien, but, like, a lot of it is just, like, slop. So I think that if she could get some bags of that, she'd be good.
That sounds like the Grandland office.
So yes.
There's not
exactly.
That much in the kitchen, I gotta say.
There's a carvery joke there, but I'm not gonna make it.
Okay.
Okay, so let's move on from Prometheus to the other major cultural happening of the weekend, which was the season finale of season 5 of Mad Men. Andy...
I thought you were going to talk about the next episode of Next Food Network stuff.
This is the thing, is that you have your shows and I have mine, but this is where we meet in the middle, is Mad Men.
Okay. That's what this podcast is about.
Yeah. I know that we seem to have disagreed about this. I was kind of underwhelmed. I know that it was a season finale, and I know that it was largely tying up some loose ends and just kind of putting an emotional kick in the crotch on what has been a kind of crotch-kicking season.
Yeah.
But I felt like it wasted a lot of time. I don't know.
Well, I don't know. I've been struggling with this, thinking about the season. I thought that it was an appropriate ending for what has been an incredible downer of a season. You know, I think we've talked about as the weeks went on here, I think that the first half of the season was almost entirely brilliant. And when the show just sort of refocused itself and became, you know, a series of sort of formalist experiments. You know, we had the horror movie episode. We had the sort of European cinema episode. And those were masterpieces to my mind, and they were really very internal and about sort of emotional development and decay and things like that. And then it was almost as if midway through the season, Matt Weiner and his writer's room were like, oh, I guess we have to service everything else now, you know, in that sort of vulgar way. We have to bring plot into it. And that culminated, obviously, last week with Lane. And then this week was sort of more about what everything has been about. This whole season has been about sort of fallout and hangover, much like my Saturday, you know. And so it seemed the appropriate place for this to go. But the more I've been thinking about it since, I found it very depressing. I found it very, very, very negative and down finale. I feel like one of the ideas I'm playing with for a piece that I have to write, if editor Dan Fuhrman is listening, please know that I'm basically done.
It's just polishing.
It's just straight polishing for the next 24 hours. I mean 10 hours. I mean 1 hour. That there was, you know, I basically for the first half of the season, and you know, something I'd written about on the site before, is that I thought that where we were headed was a place of generational conflict.
Yeah.
That Megan and to some degree Ginsburg were representing young people and young people's freedom, and what we were seeing in terms of our older familiar characters was how they were just basically powerless in the face of this. How Don had, you know, we kept saying Don had lost his fastball.
Right.
It turns out that that was sort of dropped mid-season, and it maybe wasn't really about that at all. It was sort of about the sort of impossible to avoid tentacles of business and capitalism and nihilism that sort of creeps into everything this office touches. And I felt like, you know, Don was sort of taken with Megan as this free spirit. But once in this episode, once she sort of enters his transactional economy, once she sort of says to him, you know, can you get me this part? I want it. That will be the thing that makes me happy. That will be, to use Pete's words in the hospital, my temporary bandage on a permanent wound.
Listen to you, Karl Marx.
I've been working on it. I've been thinking about this. I want you to know I'm standing up here as I'm telling you this.
Do you have like Mao's little book in your hand as you're telling me this?
I do have a jaunty cap. As soon as she said that to him, she let him down. You know, there was this real sense of disappointment, and I was speaking to my wife about this, and she read it a little bit differently. She, you know, she thought that what Don did for Megan was a little bit sad, but in a different way. It was sad in the same way that he spoke to Peggy about how that's what we do for people. We, you know, support them, allow them to be successful, and that allows them to move on.
As long as they move on with us, right? Yeah, exactly. I mean, you hope that they move on with you, right?
But you can't control that, and so maybe that's what he was saying. But really, the place that it left us in was so much darker than that. I mean, people are fixating, I think, incorrectly on that last question, are you alone?
Right.
The thing is, the preceding montage has already, and the preceding season already answered it. Yes, they are all extremely alone.
Oh yeah, I think that my question, you know, you bring up Ginsburg and you smartly link Ginsburg to Megan as this younger generation, and I do think that Ginsburg and Megan both feel sort of sublimated or suppressed by Don, you know, in a way that like Ginsburg's like, can I get one day where you tell me I'm. But it was like, can I get through one day where you tell me I'm not terrible? And Megan is sort of constantly going to Don to be like, not like whether it's approved of or set free or whatever. And it's really funny. I felt at the end of this episode kind of more like what Sal feels like, where he says, I'm really just bored of this dynamic.
Wait, when Sal says...
Sal says that in the room when Ginsburg and Draper have like their brief fight.
Oh, no, not Sal. You're thinking of...
Oh, Ken.
What's his name? Oh, the art guy. What's the
art guy's name?
Sal is the...
Sal is the original art guy. Who's the new one?
Yeah, Sal is still somewhere in Needle Park. We'll figure it out. I can't remember right now. But yes, he says he's bored of the dynamic.
Yeah, and I felt like him. You know what I mean? I was just like, you know what? I just feel like a little bit tired. Like Ginsburg had sort of like one flash of that monologue and the instance that he's just been presented as this savant. Megan, I think, had a couple of really like powerful episodes of growth, and then now since then she's just been sort of throwing herself on the bed and crying because she's not, you know, getting what she wants from life. I understand all that, but there was something about it's like I don't know. There's something about the way, and I guess I'm still thinking this through too, about the way it came, it was presented that just sort of made me a little bit tired.
It was Stan, by the way. Stan is the other guy.
Stan, sorry,
we can't think of. Yeah, to my mind, what happened this episode with Megan was also paralleled with Pete in a strange way. And I'm still playing with this idea, but the idea isn't that we learned the limits of Megan's youth. It's that maybe she suddenly was no longer young. Because I think Pete makes a big point of saying, again, in that same very, very pretty speech that he delivers to Rory Gilmore in her conveniently wiped brain. I had a problem with that. But he says something about how, you know, he had the affair because he wanted to know that all this aging was worth something.
Yeah.
And the fact that he realizes that it isn't, there's just still this hollowness, this emptiness at the base of it. And I feel like what we watch Megan go through ever since she left the office, you know, ever since she sort of just casually just dropped off something else she was good at, assuming she would still be good at everything, is that sort of that awareness of limitations that I think is what Winer's saying aging is. I mean, it's super bummer here. It's a super bummer.
Yeah, I mean, you can almost think of it like, you know, to invoke a phrase from the Rolling Stones who were featured this season, you can't always get what you want. It's just going to suck.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, she thinks that she's going to have – she just needs something because all of a sudden she realizes her life is completely – bereft, you know. There's that very I mean, we're used to the season seeing Don and Megan's kinky animalistic sex life where they basically operate like the two dogs outside of Peggy's window at the hotel. But the scene where he comes home drunk, he comes home and she's drunk, was really surprising in its sort of just I won't say savagery, but just it was so naked, unfortunately not literally, but where she's like, you know, she's drunk and he puts her to bed and she's like, you know, come on, that's all I'm good for.
Yeah.
I mean, that's quite a tumble for that character. And then to see her at the end sort of laced up in this ridiculous childlike getup.
And she's, you know, the beauty and he's the beast, right?
Possibly. I mean, I don't know.
Isn't the ad supposed to be Beauty and the Beast, right?
The ad is Beauty and the Beast. Right. I think that the Beauty and the Beast imagery, there's been this theme throughout the whole season of you know, something terrible lurking, whether it's the idea of the Phantom in this episode, whether it's the smog trying to get into their apartment.
The car crash,
Thanksgiving episode, the looming car crash, the murderer on the loose.
Who's going to go down the elevator shaft, all this stuff, yeah. And it fits, I mean, not to get too – I think that this season is actually maybe brought the action more within the walls of the advertising agency rather than looking out the window of it because – you know, I feel like this, regardless of like the opening scene of the season, it's been a very interior season, kind of. You know what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
And I think I saw on Twitter, Mark Harris actually pointed out that given the fact that Don and Peggy are seeing the first James Bond movie, Casino Royale, I think is what they're seeing.
Yeah. It's,
and then they play the music for You Only Live Twice. He's putting Mad Men in something like, what is it, January of 67, sometime
it's,
in 67?
It's April 67.
Yeah. So, I mean, It stands to reason that, like, given what was happening in America and what would certainly happen in the next year, right, like that, that there would be this feeling of doom, you know?
I think that's really right. I think that's a really good point. And I think that, you know, people may have argued that especially for a season that began with something about the civil rights movement, you know, it began with the demonstration and the other ad guys dropping water balloons, and then that led to the hiring of Dawn, who was quickly then just sort of disappeared into the background. That some people almost made that you know, they were disappointed that Winer didn't really address more of the social upheaval.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that what we're actually seeing is that he did, but in a much more subtle way. There's this feeling of dread, and there's this feeling that something is lurking outside. But the one thing that we've learned from this season is that everything has infected the office. I mean, the office is. I mean, I feel like we're still talking about Prometheus in a way. I mean, the office is infected.
It's cursed.
Everything that touches it, and in the piece that I'm working on now, I'm trying to play with this idea that everyone, it was revealed, has a price. Everyone is a whore, basically, mm-hmm. in this office. Not just the more obvious examples of Joan, but we saw Megan had a price in this last episode. We saw Ken finally reveal that he has a price for working on his father-in-law's account. And ultimately, maybe the heroine really is Peggy. I was happy to see her again. I'm sure we're going to see her next season. But if you think about her exit, there were two moments in it that were really triggered it, and one was Don literally throwing money at her. You know, which could not be more belittling,
right,
but also more in keeping with what we've seen this season. And then finally, him saying, "What's the number that'll get you to stay?"
Yeah.
And she removed herself by saying, "There is no number." And so, again, even though Dog the Bounty Hunter and Lady Dog the Bounty Hunter are getting it on outside of her Comfort Inn, she's free of it. And so maybe that was supposed to be our one glimpse of hope.
It's a
bummer.
Ask you one question. Was that Megan's friend at the bar at the end with Don?
No,
okay.
It was not. It looked like her, and I wondered if that was in some way intentional, but she did not have the strange European accent. Why am I always making fun of Europeans' accents on this show? I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Europe. No, it wasn't. And I have to say one last thing about it. I did feel a little bit of like David Chaseyan
that cut
peevishness coming into this season, into this final episode. What I mean by that is – When David Chase was making The Sopranos, he, as the creator, was horrified by Tony Soprano. He thought he was a monster. Mm-hmm. And yet I think he got more and more wound up and over the idea that no matter what he had this monster do, the audience loved him. Mm-hmm. You know, so he kept pushing near the end. He kept pushing the violence and savagery of what Tony was capable of to see if people would still love him. And I really feel like that's why at the end, the final sorry, this is going to be a small Soprano spoiler if there are any people who watch Mad Men who don't watch The Sopranos, why we were denied any resolution. Mm-hmm. Because he wanted to trap us with what we thought we wanted. He didn't want people to have
which
their
was
blood.
Onion rings. Yeah.
And I felt like this season Weiner was teasing us with the idea there's going to be a car crash and almost making us want there to be something horrible. But then he gave it, he showed it to us. He showed us Lane's body in a way that was, we thought we wanted, but we really didn't. You know, it was the consequences of it. It was really horrific. And I feel the same sensibility at work in the very end, because there are people who watch this finale whose takeaway was, yes, Don's back. Meaning
right.
Don the adulterous cad who lives his life.
Don's going to have a threesome, yeah.
And that's I don't think that's a takeaway. I feel like Weiner was saying, this is what you want? This is really what you want? Well, think about it.
You know what you're saying? You're making me think of something here. You know, we've talked often on this podcast about like what makes a showrunner or who are great showrunners. Do you think that possibly what makes a showrunner is when people start having conversations about what you're doing to them? You know what I mean? Like, it's almost like you've truly made it as a showrunner when people start talking about you as like, and Weiner won't give us this, or he's playing with us like that, or, you know, it's like,
totally.
It seems like that's really like sort of the hallmark of what we're talking about here. It's like lots of people can run a show, but only few could like really have emotional control over their viewers.
No, well, it's an amazing thing. I mean, the rise of the showrunner has been so fascinating, but it really makes sense in the sense that this is someone who has access to us basically for 13 weeks out of the year and sort of dominates our thoughts. You know, it can change our moods clearly. And, you know, people used to talk about how they would develop a relationship with Johnny Carson or David Letterman because they were in their living rooms every night. They were in their – I mean, if they watched TV in their bedroom, they were there every night.
Yeah, you hear people talk about, like, crying, like, the week that Carson went off the air.
Because there's this intimacy, and I feel like it's an almost more powerful intimacy, these people who serialize their stories and, like, whisper them to us, you know, over these periods. It's very – it is a very intense relationship that I think is only just beginning to be considered.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
because we've only had this modern era of shows for about 10 years.
Speaking of intense relationships in the modern era.
Sure.
Let's talk about the season finale of Girls.
Well, it wasn't the finale.
Oh, it wasn't. Was there another one?
Yeah, that was the penultimate. That was the Pelicano's Hammer episode.
That was with the Where's Wallace of Girls.
Yeah, exactly. No, that's interesting that you thought it was the finale. We should talk about that then. What did you think of the episode?
I don't know what I think of Girls as like a narrative show, but okay. I think that it captures the incredible emotional terrorism involved in friendships better than anything I've seen in a very long time.
Totally. Yeah. Totally. Girls are mean. Yeah, I thought, like, you know, we were coming off two episodes that I really, really enjoyed as comedies. I thought they were really well done. And then this past episode I found almost more interesting. I mean, let me just say in general, I find it really fascinating that this is a show about people learning about who they are, becoming who they are, and the show itself mirrors that. The show has been struggling to find out what it is.
It's been a couple different things, yeah.
It's been a couple different things over the course of this first season.
It was it's been mumblecore-y, it's been very straight comic Apatow, it's been like more or less Sex in the City with different clothes, and it's been these almost like moments of like kind of Cassavetes like self-examination,
right.
You know?
And we've come off these two episodes of comedy, which, you know, make everyone feel a little bit better. But even within those episodes, and we talked about it last week, there were some really sharp emotional beats. This episode, just in general, compared to some of the recent ones, I don't think it was a successful episode. I thought that, you know, Jenny Slate doing her Jenny Slate thing was just like beyond on the nose in terms of you know, the jealousy between one writer who's not good and successful and one who is. I thought that the Catherine Hahn monologue to
that was incredible
to Jessa was really interesting and really right on, but I almost thought again that was a little bit, you're showing your cards too much, because what did Jessa really do with her husband? Like, they didn't do anything.
Yeah, but I think in a lot of these situations it's just like Marnie and Hannah, and how that had been building over a couple of episodes of Marnie feeling like Hannah was kind of pulling away from her. I do think that this show does this thing where it's like, these fights aren't about any actual trespasses. They're about the suggestion of trespasses or years-long trespasses. So Catherine Hahn, even if Jessa didn't, quote, do anything, I mean, I think that's the point, is that, like, of course Jessa didn't do anything criminal. It's just that, like, she reeks of somebody who's always doing stuff, you know?
Totally, right. And she got called on her own BS on that, and I agree. And you mentioned, I mean, I was only using all that as prologue to say that the episode ends with a pretty much it's not uncut, but it's certainly unvarnished and uninterrupted 10-minute, slowly escalating, eventually apocalyptic fight between former best friends, apparently former best friends, Hannah and Marnie. And I thought that was just devastating. I mean, I thought it was incredibly brave, incredibly honest, really affecting. And again, like, you thought the season ended on that, which is even crazier, but just the fact that they ended the episode on it was really strong.
Yeah.
Because neither of them had any moral high ground. They were both, to quote unquote, to blame, but it felt, for that reason, it felt completely honest, and for that reason, very ugly.
Yeah, I mean, now I'm excited for the next the final episode. What do you think? I mean, do you think that this show has sort of proven to me that it's got legs and that it could be something that could stretch out for a couple seasons? It seems like they're really ready to let these characters, like, grow and develop.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that we knew about Lena Dunham in general is that she is not modest. She is not shy. She does not hold back physically, verbally, anything. And, you know, one thing that people sort of knee-jerk criticized from the pilot was, you know, the idea that these people were sort of privileged narcissists.
Mm-hmm.
But the show doesn't hide away from that either. I mean, they are. They're complete narcissists in much in the same way that, you know, everyone of this internet generation is. And so to see Marnie and Hannah arguing over who is a better friend to the other and who is nicer to the other during the other's problems just summed it up so much, but it was just so self-lacerating. It was almost as much as a self-caesarean. it's willing to go there, and sometimes its willingness to quote-unquote go there, I think, tips over the apple cart of just like a good half hour or a good comedy. But its bravery is remarkable, and I feel like that alone makes me really excited for the second season when they've had some time to – I mean, they're already in production for the second season.
Yeah, they're shooting now.
And there's well into it.
A couple of different people are going to be – Donald Glover is going to be on next season and
– Oi. Sorry.
What was that?
That's my reaction. I said oi. Yeah. But I'll refrain from editorializing. But I wonder how much time she had.
You don't do that.
I'm just curious how much time she had to sort of pause. I mean, one thing that, like, Matt Weiner said when he – you know, is that he has time after the season ends, and he sort of goes away and he thinks about it and then considers what he's done, you know, pluses, minuses, and where he
looks
wants to
down an elevator shaft.
He just gazes down into the wonders what terrible things he can have Christina Hendricks do this year. But in terms of Lena Dunham, I mean, she's so overwhelmed in that she is the writer, director, star, and the face of the show, so she's basically been doing press from the minute it ended. Apparently, even though they're filming the second season now, she's out doing press for, like, foreign markets. I wonder if there's been any time to sort of pause and take in both the
yeah, you never know. I mean, maybe she envisioned it as a, you know, she already had the second series season mapped out in her head.
Right.
Yeah. Well, we should move on to some other stuff happening, and you can read a lot of what we're talking about on the Grantland's pop culture blog, The Hollywood Prospectus. And, you know, one of the things that they touched on, Rembert and Dan Silver do a Trailers of the Week, and there were two pretty great ones, I thought, in this week's collection. And the first one was Django Unchained, the new revenge western from Quentin Tarantino, starring Jamie Foxx, and I can tell by your way you're talking. Are we going to get into it now? We're going to talk about your moral problems with Quentin Tarantino?
Yeah, I wish we weren't. I was talking to Rembert about this the other day.
Should we save this for, like, another day?
Well, I was talking to Rembert about this, and this is a problem I have that I'm having a hard time expressing in a clean, like, good podcast-y way. Maybe you can frame this, because you and I got into this about Inglourious Basterds.
Yeah, and I just think that part of the problem is that his movies are not marketed to your... They're not marketed to your head. They're marketed to your stomach and your heart. Like, they're kind of marketed trashily these days, because I think the assumption is that they're going to show a lot of the violence and, like, the funny lines so that everybody will come see it, and then there's a core Tarantino audience who might go for the deep cinematic references or meditations on...
I think Tarantino's only interested in the trashy parts, to be honest. I mean, I think that's what his thing is. And
I disagree with that. I mean, I think Kill Bill 2 has got...
Okay, no, let me preface this. Let me set my scene here. I, you know, adored Reservoir Dogs. Adored Pulp Fiction, was totally on the bandwagon, saw them both in the theater, super fired up. I think Jackie Brown...
Super fired up teenage Andy.
You remember that guy, back when I liked
Go
things.
Go medieval!
my voice didn't change until I was 25. Jackie Brown, I think, is probably his best film, because it had like a real, like sort of weirdly middle-age sadness and weight to it.
Saying
I
Jackie think... Brown is his best film is kind of like the, like, I'm going to Prague in my junior year of college, though, right? I mean, like, it's his best film, but like...
I'll take the hit. I think that's right. I think that Kill Bill 2 is really affecting in the ways you're talking about. I just feel like there's something about, I don't know, I find something very frustrating and limiting that the guy who is one of the most unique and fascinating directors of our time, he's a total cinematic genius, and no one makes movies just feel viscerally as exciting, for sure. But it bums me out that he just wants to sort of just keep dumpster diving in terms of genres and just sort of celebrating the trashiest parts of them instead of unpacking them. Like, Inglourious Basterds had some set pieces that were incredible. I mean, Fassbender and that's an amazing scene. Amazing scene, but I just fundamentally had a problem with the lack of seriousness about a very serious topic. I mean, I know it makes me like the boring dude at the party, or like, you know, oh, grandpa.
No, he's provocative. He's touching on a pretty serious subject this time around with slavery.
I feel like he's just dabbling with it in a very sort of way that cheapens everything. I don't like the way it makes me feel.
One thing that I'm really looking forward to with this movie though is the appearance of Leonardo DiCaprio's smile, which is something that he hasn't broken out since, like, you know, Gilbert Grape, and I don't think that was an intentional smile in that movie.
he hasn't broken out that smile since he got blackjack with Tobey Maguire and David Blaine at Vegas in 2002 at 3:30 in the morning.
Just try it on robes.
Seriously.
I'm excited to see, like, bad guy Leo, who, like, has a little bit of charm.
I like that.
One of the best things about Tarantino movies is how you never know until you see it, like, what the sort of standout incredible performance is going to be, like Robert Forster and Bridget Fonda and Jackie Brown. Nobody really thought that going into it.
Christoph Waltz in the last one.
Yeah, exactly, and Fassbender. And it's just like, in this one, I just really am, like, really excited to see Leo be a disgusting racist, sadist.
I am excited about that. What do you think about Jamie Foxx? I feel like, again, I'm putting my Mr. Morality hat to the side. I watched the trailer. I feel like I'm not sure about Jamie Foxx's
performance. Yeah, but I think Foxx has got the same job as Uma Thurman did in Kill Bill, in that he has to carry this movie. So he has to basically be the bridge through what sounds like a very panoramic plot. It's going to be moving across, like, a lot of different environments, a lot of different like sub stories. His movies are often broken down by short stories,
right.
And he's going to be the sort of through line. So I think that, and he looks great. I mean, I don't know. I'm looking forward to this. The other trailer that we had to talk about was, and I think we were both pretty into this, was Flight.
Yes, well, okay, we
Smoking
should set the
Denzel.
Scene.
Now, Robert brought this up. This is a movie about a pilot for a commercial airliner who miraculously saves 170-something people in a plane crash by pulling an incredible, upside-down plane landing situation. And then after the fact, Denzel, who plays the pilot, is accused of being drunk the night of flying, and Don Cheadle has to represent him as a lawyer. Melissa Leo looks like she's prosecuting him. John Goodman's got a ponytail. I'm all in. It's directed by Robert Zemeckis. First live-action movie since Castaway. What did you think?
Well, let me say that I came to this trailer in a unique way. When I arrive at the Grantland office after a 6 a.m. flight from New York, I am a little bit addled. I'm a little bit cracky. I walked into David Cho's office to see everyone watching this trailer, but watching the version of it that he had cut, saying he had improved it by adding No Church in the Wild to the background. So I knew nothing of the movie. I'd just gotten off a flight.
You just thought it was the sequel to Safe House.
I thought it was the sequel to Great Gatsby.
Yeah.
Like... Okay, and not only that, I just come off a plane, I don't like flying, and the plane's upside down. I was like, out on this.
Yeah.
Like the song, out on this. But then I watched it again yesterday, I was a little calmer. I mean, it's interesting because it has the big special effects set piece, but otherwise it seems very much like an earnest 1990s kind of talky, potentially inspirational kind of drama.
Yeah, it seems very like night. Like it has like the feel of like when just to date ourselves, like when A Few Good Men came out, and you're just like, this is just like movie stars being movie stars and doing a cool movie that's not about like Pandorum or whatever Avatar was about, right? Or Unobtainium.
Right. Yeah. Exactly. It's very old fashioned, but of course, it being 2012, it has to have this crazy CGI hijinks.
Yeah, but Zemeckis likes a plane crash. As Dan Silver pointed out, his last live action film was Castaway, and that had one of the best plane crashes in movie history, and this one looks pretty...
One of the best plane
one
crashes.
Of the top
I'm
three.
I'm out.
Yo, can I just say something? Crashes. If you're a pilot and you're listening to this podcast and I'm on your plane and we're going down, try something. Try something cool. Flip the plane, son. Land it in the ocean. Do whatever you want to do. I'm going to die anyway. I want to be able to tell somebody in heaven that, like, oh, my God, he tried to do, the Maverick from Top Gun, give the middle finger to the Meg thing.
You're not selling me on this storyline. Like, you have to understand that every time I get on a plane, I assume that's already what's happening. I assume anytime there's, like, we hit, like, a small rain shower that we are already fully
Isn't
upside
that
down.
The massive amounts of sedatives pumping through your bloodstream that make you think that?
Why are you snitching on me in this podcast?
I'm making you sound like a...
I'm an alcoholic, drug-popping, moralistic scold, according to you, Chris Ryan. I mean, I'm sorry, I was only there for a couple days.
I'm sorry, we're cleaning out the closet today.
I let you swim at the hotel pool. This is what I get. God. Unbelievable.
Speaking of pools, let's talk about Frank Ocean.
Oh,
yes.
You just grabbed
Nailed it.
do you want to take a second and just bask?
Fist bumps. So we're moving on to music here. We want to talk about two songs that came out this week to wrap up. One was a 9-minute single from Odd Future affiliate R&B singer and Beyonce songwriter and man of the moment, really, Frank Ocean. Who wrote
Church in the Wild crooner.
Yeah, this is like the R&B paranoid android, man.
That's what I was going to say, too, because it has even has cartoon artwork.
Yeah.
That's what it struck me as. Let me say, I feel like we're doing this guy a disservice by saying he's related to
Odd Future. Yeah, I mean, I'm just...
Because he's actually, like, a grown-up and is interesting.
For the sake of context.
Sure, no, I agree. I just feel like with this... He has this album coming out, Channel Orange, I guess it's coming out next month, and I think it will make him more just his own thing, and they will be affiliated with him, to be honest, because he is a legit interesting weirdo. But more than that, when I heard potentially indulgent 9-minute single from R&B freaky guy, I was not expecting something that is just totally engaging. It's very poppy. It's very fun. It's about both ancient Egypt and a strip club, two things that you and I both are big fans of.
Yeah, I mean, when you say 9-minute R&B song, I do think of, like, just Maxwell singing about slippers for, what I expected.
Chris, yeah. slippers are a metaphor. it's interesting because it made me think of someone else who's back in the news, who is D'Angelo.
Yes.
And are you a D'Angelo fan?
I am.
Yeah, but that said, if you told me D'Angelo had a new 9.5-minute jam, I would approach it with trepidation, despite Questlove saying that it is the second coming of R&B Jesus.
Yeah.
Whereas Frank Ocean, he does have a pop sensibility, which I appreciate. I think it's a fun song.
Yeah, it's really good. You can probably just Google Frank Ocean Pyramids, and you will you'll come across it.
I think you can listen to it on Grantland.
Oh,
maybe.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. The other song that came out this week that we wanted to touch on just briefly.
I wanted to do the whole podcast about it.
I know. It's called This Summer by Superchunk, a seminal band in me and Andy's childhood, teenage years, early 20s.
Depends how old we still are.
Yeah. I'm as old as Guy Pearce at the end of Prometheus.
That's how old I feel. That's how old I sound when I'm talking about Quentin Tarantino movies.
I will say this. The best way to get yourself into the Summer Jam sweepstakes is to put the name Summer in your song title.
Oh, and they're so smart about it. Like, it was so calculated. Like, they're always like that, too. Mac McCann from Superchunk always writes songs about summer. He had a whole album under his other nom de rock, Portastatic, called Summer of the Shark.
Yes.
Great title. Pretty good album, too. But yeah, just call it summer, make it about summer, just pander, and we are totally in. The B-side of the single is a cover of Bananarama's Cruel Summer, which I'm also a fan of. But this is just a fun rock song.
Yeah, it's great. It's great.
It made me feel very excited.
And, Superchunk is sort of having the Roger Clemens when did he go to the Blue Jays and he all of a sudden started, like, winning 30 games in a row? Like, it's like they're definitely having the HGH revival. Majesty Shredding was their last album. It was one of the best records that came out.
But I would disagree.
Was that 2 years ago?
Yeah, it was.
I know,
yeah,
you think
fantastic.
They never left because you really like that art school song.
I did. No, right. But that's what I'm going to say. I feel like if you're going to make a Roger Clemens analogy, which obviously we're going to, this is more like when Roger Clemens waited 6 months into the season and they just, like, took Cool 20 million to just, like, throw a bunch of shutouts for Houston. Right?
Yes.
He did that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, because my point is that these dudes now just know exactly who and what they are. They have other projects to do their arty stuff, and they just make cool pop punk jams nonstop, and they just pick their spots. Like, in this case, they don't have an album coming out. They just wanted to make a summer song.
That's great. I'm all for it.
And, it's a late contender, but we did tape – at some point, you guys will hear our official
Tune in. I think it's going to go up this week. Me and Rembrandt and Andy did a Songs of the Summer podcast where we sort of – We just played each other some of the three or four songs each of songs that have been like really running our summer so far, even though it's early days.
And we're also, we should note, we're taking a break from the Double Down Book Club this week because we have a special Double Down Book Club podcast coming. I don't know, Joe Hobie could yell the day, whether Wednesday or Thursday.
Thursday!
Thursday, he yells, where I had the incredible privilege of talking to George Pelicanos last week. We talked about the book club, we talked about his career, and we even talked about some authors that might show up when we do the book club in the future.
Yeah,
so,
big
things.
So
we're not doing it today. Yeah, big things.
So you guys can always just go and read.
Yeah, who, me?
No, people. Like, you know, we don't give people a lot of time to run through the collected works of James Crumley and Charles McCary when we go.
But they seem to be doing it.
It's been great. So we'll be back next week with, oh man, what are we going to talk about? I guess the finale of Girls, but like Sunday Night Television is wrapping up. I guess we'll have.
This is a super bummer.
But we'll think of something, and, you know, there's always Rock of Ages.
If there's always Rock of Ages, maybe we could still pull out a Theon Greyjoy joke. I don't know. Clearly, you have unlimited terrain to mine about my personal life that you're just going to do. You're just going to prostitute like Joan Holloway Harris all across this podcast. So
I'm looking forward
to that. Busted.
All right, I'll talk to you next week, buddy.
Bye.
We'd like to thank you for listening to today's show. For more great podcasts, check out the Pod Center page at ESPNradio.com.
Okay.